Welcome to Questions in Sustainability, a science-based podcast series that explores people, programs, and ideas in the sustainability of food systems. I am Professor Paul Vincelli from the University of Kentucky, and I'm your host for today's podcast, and it's really a pleasure to have you join us. And here are today's speaker, who's really got some excellent information for us. I do want to say that we appreciate our guests who offer their time and expertise in questions in sustainability. And of course, the views expressed by our guests, or by yours truly for that matter, do not necessarily represent those of the University of Kentucky. Our guest today is Lane Boldman, and she is the executive director of the Kentucky Conservation Committee and a legislative agent for that organization. And we'll hear more about that as we go forward. But I did want to say a little bit, there's really a lot you could say about her background and relevance to the topic today of merchant solar. But just a few things from her background. She's been working on environmental advocacy issues in Kentucky and nationally since 1992, and has been with the Kentucky Conservation Committee since 2014. She currently serves on the Lexington Corridors Commission since 2016, and her background includes being the advocacy and outreach coordinator for the Kentucky Environmental Foundation, as well as a leader in multiple positions for the Sierra Club. And that's how I know Lane is, through the Sierra Club. They're just a long list of accomplishments and activities. And I think maybe what I would most like to do is just start talking to her. We do appreciate our guest today, Lane Boldman, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Paul. Appreciate it.
So, Lane, I always like to start with kind of a snippet of your background to help people understand more about who you are. How did you get drawn into environmental work or anything? It could be anything about the person that you are in the work that you do. So why don't you give us a little introduction?
Sure. I moved to Kentucky from Ohio in the very late 80s. And at that time, I got introduced to some of the really incredible hiking areas that you have in Kentucky, the Red River Gorge, all the way down to Big South Fork. And I was not a hiker at that time in Ohio. The places aren't quite as fabulous as they are down here, although they're nice. And through that, I got involved in environmentalism through the local Sierra Club and volunteering for different groups, because I could see the damage that was happening in places that, I came to treasure, like a lot of people. So it converted me into the topic, and I did it as a volunteer for quite a long time. Never intended this to be a paid position, but I was offered the position with KCC several years ago, and I'm really happy to, use that platform to try to be more effective in my environmental outreach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so actually that sort of leads into the next question I had, and that is, what is the Kentucky Conservation Committee?
So the Kentucky Conservation Committee is one of the oldest collaborative organizations for the environment in Kentucky. A lot of people don't know it publicly. It tended to be more of a behind-the-scenes organization, but basically it came about when four of the larger environmental groups around at that time in the 70s decided that they needed a regular presence in Frankfurt. And so they chipped in together to provide the resources to have a regular legislative agent. And so we became our own entity at that time. And that's the way we still work today. We collaborate with now many, many environmental organizations across the state, and they chip in to our bottom line, and we provide them legislative services because, it's an efficient use of resources. A lot of nonprofits don't really have lobbying capacity, and we provide two legislative agents throughout the session and year round. And then we do a lot of research on both legislative issues and state government issues where the environment is a factor.
Yeah, so you're pretty well plugged into our state capital, Frankfurt, and a lot of the work that goes on there is my impression.
As much as we can be right now during the pandemic when access is a little more limited.
Yeah, indeed. So you are, I've looked into your background, of course, as a guest, and we've spoken as well, and I've talked to other people, and you were widely recognized as a very knowledgeable point person on the topic of large scale merchant solar. And that was the topic that sort of the light went on. I said, oh yeah. Well, in fact, my wife, who is a member of the Sierra Club, recommended you and on this topic. So what is large scale merchant solar? What does that mean?
Well, so merchant solar means that the power is not necessarily being built for Kentucky. It is going to go out on the open market. As people have realized that we need to quickly transition to clean energy within the last 2 years in Kentucky particularly, but in the last 5 years nationwide, it's been clear that we've needed to convert quickly and build out solar and wind in as many different forms as we can. Now, merchant scale solar is more like an industrial scale. It's many, many acres. And then there's also smaller scale community-based solar that would power a town, for example, or rooftop solar, which I have on my house. It powers your own needs up to a point, of course, until we have battery storage. And so there's many forms of solar, and solar a few years ago became, one of the least cost energy sources. It's now cheaper than coal. And so people have realized that we really do need to transition quickly for a multitude of reasons. Mm-hmm. So, but merchant is the one that has been affecting Kentucky within the last 2 years, I think most visibly. So I got, this hit my radar when we started hearing about some controversy out in Clark County over these large developments, because Kentucky is a beautiful state and it has valuable agricultural land, and you want to be very sensitive to any kind of construction that hits a region that would impact farmland and natural lands. And my organization has constituents that are very attuned to both of those issues, clean energy and appropriate land use. So I've had some experience with this in the past. When I was on the board of the National Sierra Club many years ago, we had to debate one of the very first large-scale solar farms, which was a different operation. It was called Ivanpah, and it was out in the Nevada desert. And it was in an area where there were sensitive desert tortoises in that region. And so I had been through this debate before, and I wasn't happy to get into it again without trying to be more proactive about it. The Ivanpah installation was a very different kind of plant. It was a reflective solar mirrors that concentrated solar. And it's had some impacts, but it was also one of the first to come out of a large scale. And at that time, that was, the available technology that people were discussing. But it has shown that it's had impacts to endangered species, to birds in particular. And people confuse what is happening here now with that. And even though that's a very, very different kind of installation, that would not be happening here. So I wanted to be proactive this time and see if we could get information out to the public that was more helpful to help them make good decisions about their energy choices and their land use.
Yeah. Yeah. You've brought up several points that all of which are touch points for the kinds of questions I hope to be able to ask in this interview and remember all of them. Really. Yeah. So I see a couple ways that merchant solar, which is large scale, right? It sounds like large scale on the grid kind of contributions to solar energy. So there's a couple ways that merchant solar affects or can potentially affect food system issues. And so I want to just make that point to bring the connection to the podcast. And one is, you know, the food system, of course, relies on electricity. We need power for all kinds of things, refrigeration, et cetera. So there's that. But also there are elements that you know, of the food system that may be more indirectly affected or influenced by merchant solar. And one is that there can be grazing animals associated with a merchant solar installation, which I know very little about. But what can you tell us about that sort of thing? The dual use, yeah.
And just to backtrack a little, you know, I don't consider myself an expert on all these topics at all. As a matter of fact, I think that the important thing for folks to realize is that many of these are emerging technologies, mm-hmm. and people are still learning a lot. But one of the bright spots in what I've seen in the progression of these kinds of installations is that the solar companies have realized that they really do need to be much more sensitive on how they integrate land use and solar panels. It can't just be like the installation we've seen out off of I-64 in Winchester, the EKPC solar farm, where everything is graveled and you know, you just basically clear the land, gravel it, and then put up a whole bunch of racking and panels. And that's fine if it's, you know, limited scale, but if once we're talking about these really, really large solar farms that pick up quite a lot of acreage, you really have to be much more sensitive to, you know, the kind of land you're selecting, the impact it has on the land, and can you figure out ways to make it more sustainable over the long term so that it's not just panels that are put up for 30 years while your land rests, that it can still be an active farm in some ways. So there are pilot projects out there. At one of the KU plants has sheep grazing mm-hmm. alongside their solar panels. They've designed the spacing, the height, the forage to all work together so that these sheep can graze alongside the panels. Now, I think that's wonderful. And in other cases, they've also integrated pollinator plantings alongside the panels. And mm-hmm. and we would like to see that as a pretty standard practice with these solar farms as much as possible. Now, that being said, you know, it gives the impression that all farming is compatible with solar panels, and that's not exactly accurate either. I mean, you can't have goats on the panels. They'll jump up on the panels. They'll eat the wires. So for example, there have been some pilot projects where they've been looking at what they need to do to coexist with cattle. And that's fine. And I appreciate all that research and would love to see that continue as much as possible. Mm-hmm. But it's still, you know, it's not a perfect solution at this point in time, but it's developing.
Yeah. And so, yeah, thanks for that caveat that you've added about your own assessment of your expertise and what you contribute. Actually, I think I can say that what is impressive to me is well, there's a publication called The Citizen's Guide. What is that full title?
Yeah, we put together a booklet called The Citizen's Resource Guide on Large Scale Merchant Solar, because what we were running into is when we heard about the Clark County controversy on large scale solar, that's the first place where it really where the community came out and was pushing back pretty hard on the prospect of any of these developments coming into their community. And I think it was fair on their part at first, because the company involved did not allegedly really take the time to work with the community. The siting board or the local planning commission just was going to take it upon themselves to come up with siting guidance for these kind of installations. And there was a history there in the community where they'd seen bad development in the past and they wanted to have more of a say. And I think that's totally fair.
Right.
I think one of the things we've tried to get across in this guide is that it's to everyone's advantage to work with the communities early and often and have a real collaborative process when these things come to town. But also just people weren't familiar with the processes. They hadn't prepared themselves for these kind of installations. And so, you know, you go out and search the internet to try to learn something and you're going to find a lot of very bad information okay. out on the internet
yeah.
or outdated information
yeah.
or perhaps information that was placed by, you know, some fossil fuel entity that maybe was not friendly to solar at some point in time. Or so that's what has happened. So we tried to put out a guide that at least covered the basics so that citizens could have a level playing field in the discussion mm-hmm. and provide them with at least the basic tools of here's how the process works. Here's some good practices. Here's our take on some of the myths that are often stated and just help them with tools to what we think were reliable sources.
Yeah. That's what I want to highlight and stress here in this moment is I think what I see from this publication, the Citizen's Guide that you mentioned that I've of course read through is the focus is really on, at least substantially on community engagement and transparency so that the community knows what to expect and can be part of the advocacy efforts and decision-making. So that to me is worth really stressing. Your organization is not coming in and saying, this is the way it must be, but rather the people need to be involved in this process.
Yeah, because it's really interesting. This issue, I've been pretty fascinated with this issue because I have constituents that have opinions on both sides of it. And mm-hmm. and even within, say, land conservation constituents, there are differing opinions. Some of our members are very supportive of converting farmland into solar arrays as a way to contribute to reducing global warming and helping reduce the temperatures overall that would help crops be sustainable in the long term. But then we have other members who are very concerned about more pressure being placed on agricultural lands, which are already under a great deal of threat. You know, there's 2,000 acres of land that are converted every day, according to the American Farmland Trust, away from agriculture into other uses. And so we've tried to be sensitive to both sides of that debate and just try to give people, you know, clear and we think fairly reliable information.
Yeah. Yeah. And so my students in the graduate course that I, you know, at one of the graduate courses I teach at UK, they would appreciate that because they hear me over and over say, okay, so what are the limitations for what you just presented? And, you know, tell us the limitations of your own work. And so that's what I see going on with the Kentucky Conservation Committee's work is it seems to be very much focused or allow for the fact that there are two sides and pros and cons, and we need to consider those. I am curious to zip back to something that I don't want to miss, and that is why is solar making gains in Kentucky? And I know it is because of the documentation you all have put out. So why is that happening?
Yeah, we were actually surprised when this issue started coming before us about 2 years ago. We were, as I started doing research in it, we'd only heard about a couple of solar farms, but when I looked through some of our databases, federal databases on where these projects were being explored, I was stunned. There are now about 28, 29 projects that are making their way through the state siting board. Seven or eight have been approved now. And that's just the ones that have made it to that part of the process. There are prospectors from various companies all over Kentucky that are researching, are these good areas to explore having a large scale solar farm? So it was coming pretty fast. So I contacted a friend of mine in Southern Ohio who I knew Ohio had been dealing with some of these farms earlier. And he basically updated me that because of our market, Kentucky is a very complex state for energy. We have two major transmission markets, open markets. One's called MISO and one's called PJM, where you can hook into the grid and sell onto the open market in a certain territory. And so that's part of what has made this area so attractive. Also, because other states that are also in MISO or PJM markets are have already been adopting solar, and there's only so much space, right? So now they're coming to Kentucky. They've been to Ohio, mm-hmm. they've been to North Carolina, and now Kentucky seems to be the place to be. Also, because we've retired a lot of coal power plants, we have a really robust transmission system. We have very robust lines and infrastructure mm-hmm. to deal with the transmission of solar. So it's kind of a convergence that's happened within the last couple of years that's suddenly made this area very popular to explore.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, it's I guess good for Kentucky, at least as perceived by the people that support the effort. Yeah, so.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So we've come to the part in the program where I'm always excited to introduce a piece of music. It's a distinctive feature of my podcast, Lane, is we remind ourselves that sustainability in agriculture includes quality of life, and the arts are part of quality of life. So I like to bring in that element to the podcast as we take a break, and the break is going to be about a minute or two, somewhere in there, with a portion of the music that I've selected, and then we'll come back to the program, or the content of the program, and finish out with the full song in this case. The song is actually written by and performed by the Joseph Vincelli Band. And that is my brother, so he's quite a musician, as you'll see. So we'll take a musical interlude and a kind of a mental rest for a minute or two, and then we'll come back, folks, to continue our discussion with Lane Boldman, the executive director of the Kentucky Conservation Committee. And so we'll be back. And we're back. And we are continuing on our discussion with Lane Boldman, the executive director of the Kentucky Conservation Committee. But before we do, Lane mentioned something during the break that I thought was very interesting relating to the arts. And so, Lane, what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I appreciate that you have a musical interlude within your program, because I think the arts are so important. I actually did not start my career as being an environmentalist. I started as a graphic designer and artist in publishing. And to me, I think the ability for humankind to relate to this planet is intrinsically tied to the arts. And so I don't think it was entirely an accident that I moved from the creative world into the environmental world.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that's interesting. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, because the musical interlude is kind of a something that touches my heart, and I'm always glad to do it as part of each podcast. So what are the things that you would consider limitations or drawbacks? So I know we've talked about these. Is there anything we've left out in what we've said so far?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I one of the things we've really tried to do is listen to the communities where these projects are being proposed, because so much of what comes up is very site specific, and so we try not to make a blanket judgment as to whether something is positive or negative to the community, but that the emphasis should be listen to the community. Because, I mean, Kentucky's full of really rich farmland and really special, unique wildlands. But at the same time, you know, people are looking for ways to support clean energy. I know of people that have inherited farmland that want to keep it in the family, but they don't really want to actively farm it. So for them, this is a really wonderful solution that supports their values. And I know other people that are frustrated that their communities don't have the good planning and zoning that's needed to really assess where the key agricultural lands are and do their best to protect them. So one thing I'm hoping that we get out of this legislative session, which I think will happen, is a way to both allow these farms to happen, these solar farms to happen, but happen responsibly and sustainably and with proper oversight of the community. Let the community make their decisions, but make them with good faith and good information. And then come up with creative ways to also perhaps support the sustainability of their local agricultural land as well, perhaps with certain assessments or fees that the solar companies may want to integrate that will go back into the community.
Yeah. So again, just to sort of reinforce the point I believe you've made in several ways, and that is that the Environmental Conservation Committee is really neither pro nor anti merchant solar. It doesn't seem to take a really strong position either way. You're about transparency, letting the communities know the process and dimensions of the issue, and so you're in favor of transparency as well as engagement with the community, and I find that very impressive.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say that we're not taking a strong position. I think what we're taking is a strong position for clean energy, but clean energy that's responsible. Okay. And take a strong position for farmland that is sustainable. And I find oftentimes in environmental issues that we're often presented with false choices.
Okay.
And yeah. I don't think the controversy between solar and farmland should be a false choice. I think there's ways that these things can be harmonious with each other, and we can certainly work towards them to make sure that they're as compatible as possible with the communities and with the goals of those communities and the environment.
Yeah, good. I well stated. So I'm just making a highlighted point here to myself. Clean energy that is responsible and sustainable. And yeah, so That's very very clear and very very good. In the publication, the Citizen's Guide that we've mentioned here several times, there was a section on equity considerations. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, so we want to make sure that in any energy development, we don't want to put solar on a pedestal, right? Just because mm-hmm. clean energy doesn't mean it's necessarily just energy. And so mm-hmm. One of the things that we've tried to work really closely on is making sure that any energy development still takes into consideration the history of what has happened with energy development in the past in the fossil fuel sector, which is a lot of times they're placed in areas where there are marginalized communities, people that don't have a voice. And that can still happen with clean energy as yeah. well. Yeah. And so I've tried to tell my colleagues this isn't just a matter of wanting to promote clean energy. We're wanting to promote a just transition of a system that is not continuing to be oppressive of the needs of the local community. So, for example, one of the solar farms that's being proposed, there are a few that are being proposed in eastern Kentucky. And if you hear people discuss this issue sometimes, they will say, well, I don't understand why they're building solar farms on our prime central Kentucky agricultural land. Mm-hmm. Why aren't they building it out on these old mountaintop mine sites? Well, that's a fair question, but the people that live around those mine sites still get a say in what happens in their community, right? And so one of the groups that we work with coalitions a lot, and one of the coalitions I've been working with has been people involved in infrastructure in Martin County, where the solar farm is going to be, but also where they have a lot of issues with water infrastructure. So concerned citizens of Martin County, Appalachian Citizens Law Center, Lycan Knowledge Exchange, are all groups that have been dealing with the inequities of water rates and water availability in Martin County that's been the result of years of exploitation of mining in the region. So the solar farm is the same situation, right? We want to make sure that the solar farm considers the needs of the community first, that it addresses some of the remediation issues that still exist around those sites where they're proposing to build, that the jobs are good paying jobs, that they try to source locally whenever possible, that the jobs are either union or good paying in a way that support the community. And it's not just somebody flying in to build a demonstration project that may get good press, but what does it do for the local folks? So the coalition put together a process where they surveyed the community and had a community report back. And you can find this on the Appalachian Citizens Law Center's Facebook page on the Martin County Solar Project. And so they took time to actually go out in the community and talk to citizens and see what they would like to see. Mm-hmm. And while they, were learning more about the solar proposal at the same time, they also had an opportunity to express that, their bigger needs are not just clean energy, but they needed safe, clean drinking water. They needed people to invest in their roads and infrastructure, and they needed quality jobs. And so if you're building out in that region, it's our hope that the companies that come in are looking at those same questions and are being good corporate citizens.
Hmm. This all brings to mind, and I want to repeat, clean energy is not necessarily just energy, and that's a very interesting point. But the thing this brings up for me is my experience with genetically engineered crops. Now, this is a total tangent to what we're talking about today, but I have been vocal about this to the scientific community that, if we look back over the last 30 years with respect to the technology of genetic engineering of crops, we failed miserably to engage the public, we scientists. and miserably failed. And as a result, we have, I think, a big part of that has resulted in the distrust and uncertainty people have about these technologies. So I think it's very important for scientists to remember that you're talking about here today with respect to merchant solar, you know, the transparency issue and the public engagement issue. That is a very good lesson for us in the left brain world of science and the analytical world of science to keep in mind for in general. I think the public needs to be engaged so the public can make its own decision about any of these issues and not be told what to think.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people looking at developing on mountaintop mine areas, they have to understand that out in eastern Kentucky, that's a region that has for decades been exploited for energy. And so, you know, even though it's a favorable market for some of the solar companies to come into, they have to address that history, and they have to make sure they're not coming in ways that would further that same system of not being, not letting the community lead and letting the community, you know, have some determination in their own futures. And it's interesting, right? The use of land, I mean, yeah, I keep struggling with the question of, okay, large solar farms versus, I've noticed these large developments now from companies like AppHarvest with these mega greenhouses. Mm-hmm. And it's all, how do you define farming? Some people would still define that as farming. I also would see that as a quasi-industrial operation. Just like factory farming or just like a solar farm, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got these kind of hybridized operations that are sort of farming, but sort of a large corporate entity. And so as opposed to small scale, locally owned, community supported agricultural activities. So, mm-hmm. so it's kind of an interesting debate, and I'm not here to judge one versus the other, but, mm-hmm. but you know, they, all of those larger scale operations have an impact on land use, and they have an impact on self-determination for the farmer in some cases. And it changes the dynamic on how you value your farmland. So, so it's interesting. I don't want to paint any of these as the good guy or bad guy, but I do think it raises a lot of questions.
Yeah, very, very well stated. So last question, hopefully there'll be students listening into the podcast, and I always hope for students at any level to listen in and offer their thoughts, and in fact, through the common opportunities. If there are students listening in, What would you say to them?
Yeah, so, you know, the future is theirs, right? And we need to make sure that it is a future that has less carbon in it rapidly. But, you know, large-scale solar isn't the only way to do this. There are many, many ways to do this. We're kind of in a situation where we need to do it all, whether it be rooftop, community solar, large-scale solar, or other ways to reduce carbon through better preservation of prime agricultural lands, better reforestation. You know, the land also has a use in sequestering carbon. So, mm-hmm. so our challenge for their generation is going to be how to do this rapidly, justly, with proper community involvement, and design systems that are harmonious, not competitive. And I think it can be done. I think people are looking at this, and I think people are trying very hard to do this, but we're also having to do it very rapidly. And so, which makes the community consultation even more important in this. Yeah, but it also requires communities being open to change too, right? Because for example, right up in Mason County, this is a pretty hot debate There's a lot of pro-solar folks that would like to lease their farmland up there. There's also a lot of anti-solar folks that also challenged some wind farms coming into that community several years ago. And they just may be not for changing the technology. There's a large coal plant up that way. I'm sure they're concerned that it's a threat to their jobs. So you know, we need to build up the economy, but we also need to realize that to address climate change, we need to be able to transition very quickly. And the technology is largely here now. And so how can we do this quickly without running over people in the process?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, very good. Well, listen, folks, we've been speaking to Lane Boldman, the executive director of the Kentucky Conservation Committee, and a legislative agent for that group as well. And Lane, it's been a fascinating interview. I appreciate your time and thanks for joining us.
Thanks. And if you'd like to find the guide, we have it as a downloadable. We distribute it free to communities, and you can find it on our website at kyconservation.org.
Excellent. Yeah, indeed. That's a very good download. And I'll try to make sure there's a link to that in my in some way or other in my post when I post it. And okay. And finally, so thanks, Lane. We appreciate it. So, let me also thank the Joseph Vincelli Band performing I Will Wait for You for the use of their music in this podcast. And finally, thank you all for listening to Questions in Sustainability.